Catch the NBA playoffs on Sling TV, the most flexible live TV streaming service, putting consumers in control to watch games their way with flexible subscriptions. Want to catch one game or a full series on ESPN? Grab a 1, 3, or 7-day pass. If you want to catch as many games as possible, get a monthly subscription with our ABC, NBC, and ESPN combo package. Either way, Sling lets you watch the playoffs your way with no long-term contracts. Learn more at sling.com.
This story will stay with you because it's one of the most bizarre cases I've ever come across. And today, we're going to do something unprecedented. This is the story of Bob Berdella, or Bizarre Bob, as he came to be known. What makes Bob different is not just what he did, it's how he recorded it. In a series of murders, he documented everything with Polaroids and meticulous minute-by-minute journals, almost like an evil doctor charting a patient's decline. This gives us something almost unheard of, a complete psychological map of a serial killer as he commits his crimes. But the strangest part came after his arrest. Bob agreed to give a full confession under one condition, that his words never leave the district attorney's office. He would tell everything as long as no one outside that room ever heard it. Until now. We found the entire transcript, hundreds of pages, buried for decades in the Kansas City Police Department cold storage. We also uncovered hours of rare recordings of Bob's voice. And using AI and tracking down the officers who were sitting in that room, we have reconstructed the confession in full. Throughout this episode, you will hear Bizarre Bob, in his own words, telling you his story.
And this wasn't a sit-down and planned scientific experiment by any means, but just to have some record or reference to it in the future.
The story of a strange man who literally owned his own store called Bob's Bizarre Bazaar.
In 84, I started allowing my dark fantasies to come true.
A serial killer who preyed on his own customers. A man who once killed while a taxi waited for him outside, and another while his roommate was in the very next room. I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. We're going to begin at the end, on the day of Bob's capture. And like everything else involving Bob, it's bizarre. It's April 2nd, 1988. Police respond to a 911 call in a central Kansas City neighborhood after a local meter man encounters something alarming. It's a man running for help, wearing a dog collar and nothing else. He tells bystanders that he's just escaped from a kidnapper nearby. This is reporter Tom Jackman, who covered the case as it unfolded.
It's mind-boggling. There were people who saw this naked man with a dog collar limping and didn't help him, but one person did agree to call 911.
The call goes out to KCPD's senior officer on duty, Sergeant Troy Cole, a 16-year veteran. Months later, he'll be one of only two officers who are in the room for Bob's confession.
I got a call from the dispatcher at that time. The victim, Chris Bryson, had told us that he had been hitchhiking and had been picked up by a male. The guy's name was Bob. They went to his house to have a drink. While he was at the house, he was struck in the head and woke up tied to a bed.
Reporter Tom Jackman explains what Bryson told first responders.
He tells the police that he spent the next several days being injected with things. He doesn't know what. He was gagged. His hands were beaten with the lead pipe. And he was repeatedly sexually assaulted by this man, Bob, who kept him tied to a bed. The man would leave during the day, come back at night.
According to the initial police report, detectives find the victim with ligature abrasions at the corners of his mouth, across his chest, back, and wrists. He has needle marks along his neck. He tells officers he was injected with something he describes as, quote, a liquid similar to Drano, before being beaten with pipes and belts while restrained. By the third day of captivity, Bryson sees his chance to escape. The man he knows as Bob leaves the room. Bryson hears footsteps moving down the stairs, the front door opening, and the sound of Berdella's car pulling away. He starts working at the restraints until one hand comes free, then the other.
He was on the second story of this three-story frame house, and so he opened the window and he fell down onto the concrete sidewalk and broke his leg. But he was out. He had escaped.
At that moment, Bob Berdella is at work, a short drive away. Bob runs a shop called Bob's Bazaar Bizarre, where he sells odd collectibles and unusual items. It's a reflection of his fascination with the macabre. While at the store, a neighbor calls him. This is Bob Berdella himself, recounting the story to detectives as part of his confession.
On Saturday morning, I got a call at my shop saying that the police were all over the house. I left my shop and drove to the house, knowing that there was probably only one reason for the police to be there.
When Bob arrives at the house, Sergeant Cole has already ordered the premises secured while waiting for a search warrant. Bob pulls up, calmly exits his car, and introduces himself to police.
He was approximately 6'2", a little over 200 pounds on the pudgy side.
Berdella is unassuming at first glance. He blends in. He has thick glasses, a bushy mustache, and long dark hair slicked back. He tells officers he lives alone, but he often has roommates. Neighbors know him as friendly. He's active in the community. He volunteers with PBS. He even helps out in the neighborhood crime watch.
He was very nervous. He was sweating profusely. He was quiet and subdued, didn't have much to say other than, I don't think I better talk. I better have my attorney. So our conversation was very brief. I signed the authorization and Ashley took him up and booked him.
When the warrant arrives, Sergeant Cole goes into the house and he's faced with a scene of overwhelming neglect.
I've been in a lot of houses that were bad over the course of my career, but that was the worst. It was clutter. There was dog feces scattered throughout the house. There was a turkey carcass that was rotting on the stove. The smell was, it was just putrid. I'm thinking, how in the world are we going to go through all this stuff to determine what could be and what could not be evidence?
Police are overwhelmed with the amount of clutter. At first, it's hard to determine if anything inside the home matches Bryson's story. It's then that detectives discover a hidden locked door on the second floor. Behind it is a room exactly as Bryson had described, what a task force will later designate as, quote, the torture room. Police sift through the clutter and uncover syringes with unidentified chemicals, 9mm rounds, wooden sticks, and a car battery with metal clamps attached. As the search continues, police make more unsettling discoveries. In the master bedroom where Bob sleeps, underneath the mattress, they recover a Ziploc bag. Inside is 300 Polaroid photographs. The images depict numerous men in vulnerable or unconscious states. Some appear to be in medical distress. Others appear to be unresponsive.
Are all these people dead? Where are they? Where are their bodies?
Then comes another discovery. A human skull in a hall closet, along with an envelope full of teeth. Soon, another skull is recovered, buried in a bucket in the backyard. Finally, detectives find sheets of disorganized shorthand notes, dated entries, timestamps, fragmented phrases. These are Bob's coded diaries, and investigators determine they are chronological records of actions taken against his victims.
They surmised this is Bob's shorthand for actual torture captured in progress.
The earliest journal entry begins on July 5th, 1984. 2 days later, the final note reads, quote, DD. Detectives interpret that to mean the victim has died. Another entry ends on September 26th, 1985 at midnight with the notation, quote, 86. Again, they think it means deceased. Once investigators assemble the notes, the picture becomes clear. There appear to be six victims, the first in 1984, the last in the summer of 1987, 6 months before Bryson had escaped. For the first time, Kansas City police have uncovered a serial killer, Bob Berdella. At the time, the very idea of a serial killer is very new. Investigators in Kansas City have never handled a case like this before, and when they start digging, they realize something chilling. Bob had been right under their noses for years. He had quietly been the prime suspect in multiple investigations, cases that were later abandoned for reasons no one can fully explain.
It's obviously the biggest case that I've ever been involved in. He was the first serial killer that we had here in Kansas City. There's been one since, but he was the first.
Bob Berdella is born in Ohio, where he attends Cuyahoga Falls High School.
I was involved in the Stamp Club. I think one of the algebra clubs. Never did get involved in a lot of school activity.
It's 1966. Bob is 16, and his life suddenly changes. During a Christmas visit with relatives, his father dies unexpectedly from a heart attack. This will affect Bob profoundly and change the course of his life.
It was over a Christmas holiday down in Canton, visiting relatives. He had trouble breathing, went in for a respiratory problem, and the second night he was there during his sleep, he started coughing and apparently unwedged some cholesterol that went into his heart and basically gave him a heart attack.
The tragedy reshapes Bob's worldview completely. He's already carrying a secret he feels he can't share with anyone. He's gay, living in a time and place that refused to accept him for who he is. He never tells his father, and even at the time of his confession, decades later, he admits that he's never discussed it with his mother. That silence leaves him sitting with shame he never resolves. His father was only 39, with no history of health issues. After the death, Bob's emotions turn inward and darken. His grief hardens into resentment, and his worldview begins to corrode. He starts to grow cynical towards education, politics, religion. Everything he once believed in feels hollow now. After graduation, Bob leaves Ohio. He moves to Kansas City to attend the Art Institute and lives in the dorms. He majors in painting and ceramics, hoping to become a college professor, and for the first time, he's able to live openly as a gay man. In his junior year, Berdella is arrested in a small drug-related incident. To pay legal fees, he starts working in the restaurant industry.
And very quickly found out I could make twice as much flipping hamburgers as I could as a college professor in that field.
Within a few years, Berdella becomes an executive chef, saves money, and this is how he's able to buy the two-story home on Charlotte Street. It's the same house police will search years later.
I bought the house. It was through a mortgage company. I put $100 down and started making payments.
By 1971, Berdella has become deeply interested in ancient Roman and Egyptian artifacts. He collects and sells them out of his home. This is where he begins to fill his house with collectibles, eventually establishing a shop in the Westport Flea Market.
For the first 4 or 5 years, from about 71 through 76, I was collecting and dealing in Roman and Egyptian artifacts, ancient artifacts more associated with the Mideast, and at 76, I had just gotten into folk art.
In 1981, Bob is laid off from his executive chef job. He begins to work at the flea market booth full-time, renaming it Bob's Bazaar Bazaar. We track down one of Bob's former roommates, a man named Paul Cooper, who lived with Bob at the Charlotte Street house, moving out a year before Bob's arrest.
But it was Bazaar Bazaar, because he was bizarre. His stuff is in there, was bizarre.
When I talked to Paul, I wanted to know what Bob was really like. he described him as eccentric, strange, yes, but also surprisingly respected in the small world of niche art and collectibles.
I saw numerous times where people would come to Bob and have him appraise their art. So he was well known in the art community. And Bob told me that's where he made his real money, you know.
Bob is known for his obscure knowledge of gems. And he always has his hands in something. The shop, selling odds and ends out of his house, jewelry making, all sorts of odd ventures. He barters with anyone who will barter back.
He was cheap. You know, and like he had a rule. He was an atheist, right? Complete, a true atheist. He had this rule that says, there's only one commandment from God, and that is thou shalt not pay retail. And he did not.
He never gets angry. He never raises his voice. He's polite, but he's undeniably bizarre.
We went to a toga party. I had never been to a toga party in my life, didn't even really know what one was. It was cold outside, wintertime. I was dressed in regular clothes with a coat. He had a full-length rabbit fur coat on and flip-flops. We went to the party, and the hostess came up to us to take our coats. I took my coat. People were in togas. Bob took off that fur coat and didn't have a stitch on. He didn't have a thing on but his necklace and his flip-flops. That's Bob. That was Berdella. And you either could go with that or you couldn't be with Bob. He was that type of a guy.
Berdella also keeps large dogs that he breeds and sells. And through these animals, he's able to purchase veterinary supplies. These are medications typically intended for animal care.
I was getting everything from vitamins, calcium pills, vaccines, and then also was able to get some of the tranquilizers, aspromazine, chlorpromazine, and ketamine.
Investigators will come across numerous reports of Bob using these substances socially. He sells them, trades them, or offers them in exchange for companionship. Bob is known to frequent gay bars downtown, a local park, and a bus station where many vulnerable young men pass through. One witness tells police a story of spending the night at Bob's house. Bob provided these medications in exchange for being held in the man's arms all night. The man tells police, quote, "It was like Bob was scared or insecure." It's around this time that Bob begins what he later calls test runs. He invites young men to his house for consensual encounters, often trading items or substances for companionship. Some guests would become heavily sedated and have little or no memory of what happened. This is something the men didn't understand till years later. We found a witness report in the Kansas City Police Archives in which a man who knew Bob describes a disturbing pattern. Bob offering drugs, the men becoming sedated, and then being restrained. It reads in part, quote, "He had seen three or four different white males, 21 to 26 years of age, tied up in Berdella's bedroom." The witness says the victims would try to resist. He says, quote, "They would tell Berdella to stop, but he wouldn't stop, and they couldn't defend themselves." Bob's Polaroids of this time are later discovered under his mattress. And this is where he begins to keep notes on medications and his victims' reactions.
This wasn't a sit-down and planned scientific experiment by any means, but just to have some record or reference to it in the future.
According to Bob, his actions are an attempt to recreate a movie he became obsessed with as a teenager. An Oscar-nominated 1965 horror film called The Collector, starring Terrence Stamp, about a socially awkward young man who abducts a woman and holds her captive in his cellar.
A film that I saw as a teenager that I guess left a lasting fantasy, a dark fantasy in my mind, was a film called The Collector. The movie just gave me the framework to be able to fantasize it. And in 84, I started allowing my dark fantasies to come true.
It's July 5th, 1984, and we're 4 years before Berdella's arrest. Bob picks up a 19-year-old named Jerry Howell at a bus station near his home. Witnesses report seeing Jerry at a 7-Eleven with Bob on 36th and Main Street.
The first victim was Jerry Howell. This death happened in my house, as did all the deaths.
Now here's the strange part. Jerry is no stranger to Bob. In fact, Bob knows Jerry and his father. Jerry's father owns the store next to Bob's Bazaar Bazaar at the Westport Flea Market.
Jerry informed me that he had started tricking first down on Independence Avenue and then down at 10th and McGee. This is the first time that I became aware of any information that Jerry was in any way, shape, or form involved with gangs. And I don't think he was 18 at this time.
Over the years, Bob had taken advantage of Jerry's vulnerability. Bob once helped Jerry to get a dentist appointment. Another time, Jerry needed a lawyer and Bob stepped in. But Bob's motivations are not purely generous. Jerry always ends up at Bob's house to repay the debt. On the night of Jerry's disappearance, the pattern repeats itself.
The only intent on going over to my house was just that, to party.
On July 5th, 1984, Bob begins writing in his journals 6 minutes after Jerry is last seen. He documents doses and medications at 6 p.m., 6:20, 6:40, 7 p.m., and then continues with minute-by-minute notations until 11:45 p.m., when Jerry is truly sedated.
This is the first time I had done anything like this.
This moment gives us extraordinary insight into Bob's mind. It takes him more than 5 hours to fully subdue and capture Jerry. 5 hours in which any reasonable person might rethink, reconsider, reevaluate, yet Bob remains detached and clinical. He's a true psychopath, unable to grasp or simply unable to truly care about the gravity of what he's doing.
Perhaps it wasn't pleasurable, but satisfied a need or an emotion that I had at the time.
Bob spends the entire night letting his dark fantasies run wild. The next day, Bob leaves for work with Jerry still restrained. When he returns, he picks up exactly where he left off. He documents the pattern in his journal, a slow, deliberate cycle of sedation, reaction, abuse, more reaction, and more sedation. It's a methodical clinical routine, and he repeats it hour after hour after hour.
There was no intent to hurt him, i.e. torture or anything like that. My motivation was mainly to have control over the situation.
According to Bob, Jerry's physical condition worsens due to the prolonged restraint and sedation. At one point, Bob leaves the room briefly. When he returns, Jerry is unresponsive.
The second day, he was at my house. He apparently asphyxiated and checked for a pulse. I tried to use some resuscitation. Tried this for probably 2 or 3 minutes and got no response. First, I brought him down to the basement, then came back up and tried to figure out what to do. It appeared that the only viable option was to dismember him and have the trash pick it up.
This is a method Bob will repeat 5 more times.
All the bodies sat out on the curb for the trashman to pick up on Monday morning.
Jerry's disappearance immediately alarms his family. He's been excited for a Michael Jackson concert and had tickets that he never picked up. When he doesn't show, they file a missing persons report with the Kansas City Police Department. After sifting through boxes, we recovered the case file of the Jerry Howell investigation. One of the first person police interview is Jerry's father, Paul, who immediately points the finger at Berdella. Witnesses also confirm Jerry was last seen with Bob. This prompts investigators to interview Bob himself. He lies, claiming he dropped Jerry off at 7-Eleven and went home. He provides no evidence, no alibi. He says Jerry, quote, owed a lot of money to people and, quote, could have been picked up by anyone. Investigators are suspicious and they even write down their suspicion. In one part of the interview, the investigator writes, quote, it should be noted that during the interview, Mr. Berdella appeared very nervous and sweating a lot. Yet the case file shows that investigators conducted minimal follow-up. After speaking to Bob and a few more interviews, the case is essentially abandoned in favor of other cases. In truth, this failure was shaped by the era. Police lean into harmful stereotypes about gay men, and as a result, they dismiss crucial information. Bob is targeting marginalized young men, and law enforcement largely overlook their experiences. And Bob knew this. Years later, during a search of his home, police recover an envelope buried in his closet. On the front, Bob has written, "House guest." Inside is newspaper clippings and missing persons posters, all following the investigation and disappearance of Jerry Howell. That's what still haunts me. Bob was aware of the investigation into his first victim, but he understood that no one could stop him. Not the neighbors, not the police, not the witnesses who reported him. After committing his first murder, Bob just slips back into his routine. He works at the flea market, he's selling artifacts, he's volunteering for the neighborhood watch. The mask of normality holds. But behind the mask, in the secret room on Bob's second floor, Bob is evolving. The mistakes he made with Jerry, he corrects. And the fantasies he saw in the movies, he begins perfecting. Because Jerry Howell wasn't the end of something, it was the beginning. In part two, we go deeper into Bob's diaries, and into the years when his fantasies darken into a calculated pattern of abduction, captivity, and murder. We'll talk about the victims who vanished inside Bob's house, the police who missed the signs, and the roommate who unknowingly was standing just a few feet away when Bob committed a murder. Bizarre Bob thought no one could see him, but eventually the truth caught up. That's next time on Unmarked. If you go to our social channels, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, you'll see additional content about this episode, more phone calls, insights, and interviews. And we'll be posting daily from the last decade of our true crime reporting. This season on Unmarked, you'll hear exclusive audio and interviews, calls and content, including the last interview with Charles Manson. We're opening our archives one case at a time. Subscribe to Unmarked so you don't miss what we reveal next. This episode of Unmarked is produced by John Nadeau, edited by Dave Alderson, and our additional producers are Jesse Demaray and Steve McClellan.